money of the Jewish people. Lenachal Tam,
ye shall move. And for their inheritance, for their portion, they will spend. So, we know that it costs a lot. And Hadassah magazine wasn't the first to say being Jewish costs a lot of money. You know, Hadassah magazine a couple years ago broke the story. It's so expensive to be Jewish. Shul dues, day school tuition, trips to Israel, summer camp,
kosher food.
And the rabbis already knew it's going to cost us some money. And it's going to be for the notion of having a great heritage of generations, of your portion, of all kinds of delights that await you. Now, that's right, it's an investment. It's an investment. The Gemara proceeds to cite the verse from Isaiah, which speaks of one who delights in Shabbat as being rewarded with the portion, though, of what? Of Jacob. Now, just remember for a minute what that's going to mean. Some commentators explain that the portion of Abraham was shared with the descendants of Ishmael and Lot, and part of Isaac's portion was given to Esau. But vis-a-vis Yaakov, there is no dividing it up. Now it's just the Jewish portion. So you're going to sustain a Jewish family by investing in the Sabbath. Now, nothing is new under the sun. Right? You've heard the very famous line, like I have, nothing has kept the Jewish people more than the Sabbath. The Sabbath is what has kept the Jewish people. So, and who's it said? They say Abba Ibn said it. But really it's a Chad Ha'am.
From here.
It's really not. It's kind of a modern quip. I don't see it in the Nusach of any of the ancient Midrash. We'll have to look. Maybe there's a Hebraic way that I'm not searching for. What's that? Oh, that's quite nice, right? Except that it's not. Why, Bobby? Because our home celebration week to week was not like the prayer worship that church thing was embedded in. I can't remember right now which of the great sociologists who talks about this. It's either Charles Liebman or it's the classic Varieties of Religious Experience, William James, where he's talking about the difference between worship in a center versus the table as place of prayer and song. And the kind of cultural celebratory nature of Jewish life that has a holiday every week. You know, what's this? A holiday every week. The Sabbath becomes the kind of culture, the milieu of the Jewish family. And that had provided for the Gemara the sense that this we have a formula of keeping the people alive, of showing them that they have portion, whatever that means, an inheritance. And then it will ultimately mean somewhat about redemption. And remember that the Sabbath is an institution that says also, you're going to toil. But we're going to put into your human experience the kind of rest that you should gain. Not only in Olam Haba, but it's going to be a ta'am shel Olam Haba. It's going to be a taste of the world to come. And they're very conscious about doing this. This is a completely radical idea that you shouldn't have to work this hard on an everyday basis, to not plow, to not sow, to not reap. It's the season. And that is what makes this legislation, in a way, so radical. What do you want? You want to say about ancient cultures that also had days of rest?
I'm not going to tell you anymore. It's okay. I know exactly where it came from. Yeah.
Share, because I...
Okay.
We cannot keep
Some people believe that, you know, God's secrets were shared with others before they were shared with us.
So are there precursors?
Sure. Because in the Sumerians, they created human beings to do the work of God. So to do, because God complained, so they didn't want to do any more work, so they created human beings. So you think about it, the gods wanted to rest. So here, what's the revolution of Judaism? It's taking the, we'll say non-sacred, well, I'll say, I don't want to get into that to discuss. Okay, the revolution of Judaism is to take it and to bring it to the human being, and say the human being needs to rest. But the concept of needing to rest is an ancient concept.
Yeah. Well, God rested in Torah, of course.
And God rested in Torah, but God rested in Torah still 2,000 years later.
If you want to go that direction of historical moments in time, or you have implanted within the world a cycle of Sabbath that is somehow revealed to others,
right,
that is consecrated into a certain kind of giving over of law that makes it statutory for human beings and humanity,
right,
and that's the revolution of Torah. So, back to it, I want to show you then what the Gemara does with it, vis-a-vis this inheritance. So the Gemara says, if I'm going to say something, I have to prove it with a verse, because that's the way that verses work for us, that there's proof text that ultimately comes to demonstrate through sacred attention, through our attention to the sacred text, this is indeed what is the fact. Well, whoever delights in the Sabbath is granted a boundless heritage, as it said, Shenem Mar. Technically, Shenem Mar invites us to a verse from most of the time Torah, if not Tanakh. As titanaga Adonai v'hir kavticha al b'matei aretz v'ha'achalticha, and etc. Then you shall be granted pleasure with God, and I shall mount you astride the heights of the world, and I will provide you the heritage of your forefather Jacob, Nachalat Yaakov Avicha. So that is said in Kiddush on Shabbat for those who say the extended version, and add the first paragraph from the prophet before they get to Vishamru. It's always a reminder that your portion is with that of Jacob. And again, that portion, being of Jacob, is not like that of Abraham, regarding whom it's written, Locha Avraham, shekatuv bo, kum hitalech ba'aretz l'orka. Go and get up, arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth. I'll give it to you. Mind you, the technicality, if you're a technical Gemara learner, first it says, Shine Emar, and brought you the verse to prove to you that your portion was like that of Jacob. Here it says, like, in the next phrase that is proving that it's not like someone, that it's not Shine Emar, but it's Cha Abraham Shekatuv Bo. That it's written like this. So it's not the Shine Emar, the strength of Shine Emar. V'lo Chayitzka. And it's not like Isaac Shekatuv Bo, that's written like him, Ki Lecha L'Zarecha Etenet Kol Ha'aretz Odael. To you and your offspring I'll give these lands. Elech Yaakov. Rather, it's like Jacob. You should feel connected to Jacob. Shekatuv bo, as it's written, Ufaratzta yama v'kedmat tzafon v'negba. Rather, your heritage will be like that of Jacob, regarding whom it's written, and you shall burst out westward, eastward, northward, and southward, without any limit or border. And remember, we talked about this being the place where there is the recognition of two things. One, it's like Jacob, the original family, one father for all the tribes, bringing us back to the idea of one father for all the tribes and no one else. As in, not Esav with Isaac, as in, not Yishmael with Avraham. It's a pure bloodline. And two, that it's like Yaakov, whose children would ultimately land not only in Eretz Yisrael proper, but say on the other side of the river where they asked for a portion. Right? There's several tribes who live just east of the Jordan River. And then the hint that the diaspora would be real. The Gemara is written where? In Babylonia, just east of that river, right? So you have the whole landscape there of the diaspora. Your portion is like that of Yaakov. Sometimes people say too, wait a minute, why are we called B'nai Yisrael? Why not B'nai Avraham? Why aren't we called the children of Abraham? Sometimes we actually are called the children of Abraham, here and there. Generally, we're B'nai Yisrael or B'nai Yaakov. Okay, let's push forward. Another benefit. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak Amar. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak comes and says, Nitzol mishibud galuyot. He's spared from the oppression of exiles. Ketiv hacha v'hirkav ticha album teyaretz. It's written here concerning one who delights in the Sabbath, and I shall mount you astride the heights of the world. Uchativ hatam va'ata al bamotemo tidrocha. And it's written there, your foes will try to deceive you, but you'll trample upon their haughty ones. Or
go back to why we're called the children of Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying it's because if we said we were the children of Abraham, we could talk about Ishmael and so forth, as you just said. Is that your answer to why?
Well, that's one part of the... It's a, that's one aspect of the question. Definitely.
I think we have a progression here. Avraham, kum hitalech ba'aretz. In other words, explore. Then Yitzchak, it says, I'm going to give you this land. And Jacob is already, you have it, and then you will expand. The progression of the inheritance here.
Mm-hmm.
You said last time it was military.
Right.
In a way.
Right, you could see a progression. But there's no progression in holiness by way of the tradition. Abraham is as holy as Yitzchak, is as holy as Yaakov.
You're talking about in terms of the description of the relationship with the land, and the most definitive and the most widespread when it comes to Yaakov. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry,
I thought you said the progression, though, has to do with the patriarch's relationship to the land.
Yeah.
And by the time we get to Yaakov, it's the most definitive, it shows
that's
the widest range of ownership, it's not just exploring, it's already taking ownership.
That's exactly what I have in mind. Exactly.
I was just paraphrasing.
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right.
But also his name became Israel.
Right.
Yeah. Yaakov is the most Jewish of all three, I think.
Not just changed his name, but he fought with the angel.
Right. He fought with the angel.
He was the lucky one.
But Isaac never left the land. He's the only one who lived his whole life on the land. So, I mean, you could make an argument. Isaac had short shrift.
Listen, the whole notion here is that I think that the rabbi's project, just very plainly, is that we're going to Bnei Yaakov because A, it's a pure bloodline, and B, it's the most expansive when it comes to diaspora Judaism. They're justifying the relationship not to be in Israel. Bluntly. On the other hand, they are saying that you have a portion there, no matter what, if you find yourself outside of the land of Israel.
Which they are. Interesting, in modern parlance now, everybody talks about the Abrahamic religions, the three Abrahamic religions. Just a nuance in what we're talking about.
True, true. I mean, my short quip to that is...
It's not really a Jewish concept.
My short quip to that is that Abrahamic faith, right? And finding the common thread sometimes leads to the least common denominator. Okay. So... It's true. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak says the following. You're going to be rescued from oppression of exile. Now, our professor, our teacher, I could say, Amy's here tonight, Charlotte von Robert, whom I talked about once from the Bima, writes about the Gemara, by way of her teacher, Daniel Bayaran, saying that Gemara is sometimes anti-colonial literature. And so there's going to be a trope of trying to understand how we get out of political suffering. That we're being oppressed by forces that are way beyond our control. In Eretz Yisrael, it was Rome, and it's still the Romans, and the Romans are looked at as enemies. You know, the rabbis, I would say, were late. If you look at Heinrich Gretz's great history, you know, multi-volume history of the Jewish people, you know, the chief architect of history in Wissenschaft Judentums, the one who's writing fantastic history, if not sometimes bordering on historiography, but let's say that it's a full investigation of peoplehood from throughout time, and he says, the rabbis are basically late in realizing that Rome is losing power. You know, from their standpoint in Babylonia, Rome is still very much in charge of what's going on over there, but Byzantium and the kind of downfall of Rome that's happening before the 7th, 8th century is kind of, you know, it's still looked at as, you know, very much that Rome is in the oppressor role and we have to not live within the role of oppression. Of course, a little bit of that is thinking about Sasanian Persian rule where the Babylonian sages are, and trying to figure out how to live and navigate within that and keep a religious community going. And Shabbat, again, becomes a way of absolutely selling the notion that we have a people who's very much alive, and it's your inheritance, and you're connected to Yaakov, and you're connected to Israel. And so if you keep Shabbat, you don't suffer the great oppression of exile, as it's written here with regard to Shabbat, and I will cause you to ride on the heights, right? And ultimately, it means that Rabbi Yehuda and Rav said, with regard to anyone who delights in Shabbat, God grants him his heart's desires, as it's stated, and you shall delight in God, and he'll grant you your heart's desires. Meaning that time of reflection on the Sabbath is really the time to feel free, like you're in control of life. Because it's juxtaposed with the limud about exile and about the oppression of exile. This delight in God is mentioned in the verse, the delight in God which is mentioned in the verse, I do not know what it is. When it says, and you shall call the Shabbat delight, one must say, it is the delight of Shabbat. And so we go back over and says, V'yitim lecha mishalot libecha. Oneg zeh. I don't know what's really meant by this delight. And when it is called the delight, Heve Omer Ze Oneg Shabbat, I would say that it refers to the delight of the Sabbath. So, you see in note 13 in the art scroll, if you're using it, some authorities rule that Oneg Shabbos is a Torah requirement. So, other authorities maintain that it's an enactment of the prophets or the rabbis. Meanwhile, what is Oneg Shabbat? Okay, now I have to get into some tachlis. Jewish people can't just leave it by way of feeling glad. I have to have some way to concretize this. What's the way I concretize the notion of delight in Shabbat? B'man go. Food. This is going to be the answer. If you want to know how to set your Shabbos table, go to the Gemara. And that's fulfilling the commandment of Oneg Shabbat. Rav Yehuda Barei de Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat Mishmei de Rav Amar. Rav Yehuda, the son of Rav Shmuel Bar Shilat, said in the name of Rav, "B'tavshil shel teradin v'dagim gedolim v'roshe shumin," with a dish of cooked beets, large fish, and cloves of garlic.
Is that all together?
Well, you know, I could just see the fish laying in the middle, the beets on the outside, the garlic crown. I think you could say together or apart. There's not so many machlokot rishonim on that issue. The sages don't get into whether or not it's one recipe or another, but it's a very good question. And if you look below, these particular foods were highly regarded in Talmudic times. In other times and places, any similarly esteemed dishes required bread eaten for the Sabbath meals. That fulfills the requirement of Oneg Shabbat. The Shulchan Aruch rules that one increases consumption of meat, wine, and dainties on the Sabbath. So I think I told you last time about our garlic amnesty at our Shabbat table in Jerusalem. So we would get huge in Jerusalem in the Shuk. You can buy cloves of garlic like you buy a kilo of strawberries. And so they scoop it out and they put it in a bag and you come home and you've got a kilo of garlic cloves. And you buy a little toaster oven or two, because they don't have real ovens in Nachlaot at that time. Just like crazy metal shacks before the neighborhood is gentrifying that we happen to live in. And so we have a couple of toaster ovens. And one toaster oven is filled with garlic. You slice it off, and the garlic becomes buttery inside. And you make mochi over the bread. And the first thing you have is garlic spread over your challah. It's just divine. But you have to declare garlic amnesty for the meal. And then the next thing you eat is fish in a typical around the Shabbat world. And you remember I brought the book from Moshe Chalamish about gefilte fish, that it was a late invention, and that there were all these other types of fish. And this is where we touched on this before. The interesting thing is that since that class, I was talking with a family in Israel about the kind of fish that they make. And I asked them this question that we came up upon. What's gefilte mean? Yeah. Right? That's what we said. Because it was originally like this stuffing within this piece of fish. And so this Yiddish speaker happened to say, gefilte? Gefilte was the word we used for a mess of fish. Whatever mess of fish the mocher sold us, that we called it gefilte. So, just a hodgepodge, just another perspective from a Yiddish speaker to this day.
Exile is still in my brain.
Mm.
But how much were they in 200 CE exiled? Meaning, were they in fact not allowed to go back to the land of Israel at that point? I mean, I was under the impression that you know, Cyrus is 539 BCE. So here we're 200 CE, and they're still there, and I assume they chose to be there rather than being shackled to being there.
Right. So there's wonderful work on the topic of, are they exiled? Are they rewriting the land of Israel and the promised land onto Babylonia even? And calling this the promised land of learning and rabbinic institutional development. In Gemara and Kiddushin, you have the entire discussion of whether someone should get married first and then go learn in the Jerusalem academies and then come back home, or go learn in the Jerusalem academy and then come back to get married. So we know that there's some passing back to the Holy Land. The notion of that the rabbis don't live fully in the kind of Shilton, Memshalah, governmental control of that land, makes them feel in exile even in their land. And this is some of the way that the scholarship defines the attitude to the land of Israel, even in the Palestinian Talmud, even in the Yerushalmi, because of the way that they've lost their control. The Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. Remember, 125, the launch from Crete. Let's go and reconquer the land and rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. It's rejected. Bar Kokhba's not going to happen. The exilarch over here, the leader of the community, the Nasi over here, the president who has to deal with the authorities. This is the kind of textured approach to Israel, that though they're in the land, the promise is not yet there. So I think you ask the right question. You know, are they seeing this as, I need to get back to be in the land itself from Babylonia?
Or is this that if I go back, I'm going to be under Roman rule?
That's it.
And that means that in exchange for being in the land, I'm going to be oppressed.
That's right. And therefore, the promised land is not in our hands, and thusly not the promised land at all. Katsrin. Yeah, right, in the north. You mean you have Talmudic era villages. You have Talmudic communities all over. You have Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, the Tanaim are all over the land of Israel. It's not like the Palestinian Talmud wasn't created first. Then there's the Babylonian Talmud afterwards because of the community's longevity within, again, Sasanian Persia is the theater there. And sometimes they even write the land of Israel onto the Babylonian existence they have. But it's obvious they're feeling exile even in the land themselves. Itself. Okay.
It's an analogy to, for example, the Haredi non-Zionists who live in Israel now. Instead of Rome being in control, you have a quote-unquote secular Israeli government.
Yeah. I think it's a little bit different because of the notion of the, you know, the nature of their belief about the currency of Jewish ideas and Jewish practice, etc. There are those who do not feel that just being with their feet on the ground, let's say, is the promise of being in Eretz Yisrael, in the promised land. All right, the Gemara is going to go on, and I'm on the right-hand column of 118b1 if you're in the art scroll. Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Kol HaMeshamer Shabbat Kihilchato, whoever observes the Sabbath according to its law, Afilo Oved Avodah Zarah, even if he worships idols, Kedor Enosh, like the generation of Enosh, Mochalin Lo, he's forgiven. Now, that What is that hinting at? Shenemar Ashrei Enosh Yaseh Zot. As it says, happy is the man, Enosh, who does this, who safeguards the Sabbath from desecrating it. Mechalalo. Al Tikri Mechalalo. Don't pronounce it Mechalalo. This is a kind of homiletic move here, and a homonymic. Ela Machulo. But rather, Machulo. It is forgiven him. It was in Enosh's time that people began to worship idols, as it says, and to Shet was born a son, and he named him Enosh. Then to call on God's name became profaned. That generation introduced idolatry, and one who worships idols is as if he had rejected the Torah in its entirety, and thus Sabbath observance atones for idolatry. So what's the hint here? I read an interesting piece that said, this is a hint that you had people who were once idol worshippers moving into what we call the boundaries of our peoplehood. Is it conversion qua conversion in any kind of formal way? Nobody stopped here to make a commentary in the Talmud that there's a certain kind of ceremonial conversion, and I don't want to get into the details of ceremonial conversion right now. We could, you know, someone could theoretically ask, well, what was it like at that time, and this and that. I'd like not to go there, if I may. But is it a hint of that? Is it a hint that certain idol worshippers found themselves just within the community because they were working for Jews, and then they keep Shabbat, and they kept Shabbat a second time, and a fifth time, and they say, wow, you know, I'm sure that guy's going to be forgiven, all the idol worship that we've thought of him as an idol worshiper. So it could be just very kind of sociologically real like that. Could be that there's an actual conversion. Could be that they're selling the idea and that they're talking about anti-Zoroastrianism. If this is Bavel, and if people are coming over to the fray, and if people come to say that they understand rabbinic law as being definitively the right way to honor this sacred text, and they become people who are Shomrei Shabbat, keepers of the Sabbath, could be that they're rejecting their local religious standards that are called here Avodah Zarah, because the Zoroastrian faith for sure is looked at as having dual powers, and it's fitting into that nature of what the rabbis define as idol worship. I think that's what the implication is.
Oh, okay, because it seems inconceivable that if they're still idle.
No. I think it's that they're
that
moving.
They once were.
But even Jews could have in fact been idol worshippers, you know.
Yeah, let me go back a little bit and say it could be a way to sell people on, you know, staying straight.
Right.
Right, and then that's the generation that's
so
bringing idol
like
worship into the world.
Generation after Adam,
right.
Is idol
right.
Interesting.
Right, because remember that we read Midrash this summer. Beautiful Midrash this summer on Adam Rishon, the first person. What did the first person do? And where did he do it? He's the first one to organize a very, very serious ritual sacrificial system on Har HaBayit. On Mount Moriah, on the spot where the Beit HaMikdash would be created. The rabbis themselves write that into the Midrash about Adam HaRishon.
Is that the same spot that Abraham took
out? That's the spot. That's the altar. So then by the third generation, though, there's rebellion. And God's name is made profane. Now we get into a piece that I want to hang with a little bit with some source work. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda says that Rav says, Ilmale Shamru Yisrael Shabbat Rishona. If the Jewish people had only observed the first Shabbat, Lo Shalta Bahen Uma V'Lashon. No race or nation could have assailed them. If only we observed that first Sabbath. Shenemar, as it's written, to bring you the proof of the verse, Vayihi bayom ha-shvi'i yatsu min ha'am lilkot, as it says, after they get the Sabbath laws, what happens in the Torah? It happened on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather. Some of the people, even though Moses had told them that no manna would appear on the Sabbath, they nevertheless went out to gather it. They took their vessels with them and thereby transgressed the malacha of carrying. What's that?
We have in the Gemara the law of Mitzatoke Kulo.
Okay.
When you see Shiva, you can have the last day, you can see it just 1 hour and then...
Okay.
So the same here. They went for morning prayer in Shul on Shabbat and then they went away.
Yeah, unfortunately it doesn't work with the Sabbath.
Why not?
Never does.
It
doesn't apply.
But it says in the Torah that the sins only go down 3 or 4 generations.
So if you want to go into the discussion in the Gemara, do they really get delivered onto the children? Do they not get delivered onto the children? Intertextual midrash about such an issue.
But here
they don't want to apply that limud. This is one of those places where the rectification with a different limud, with a different principle, doesn't get rectified. The rabbis all the time don't have to be harmonious within that system. One lesson that we learn over here doesn't come to undermine or undo a lesson over there all the time. Though that's some of the work of other methodologies, but the starting point is, how do I harmonize this? How do I know that this could have been true even given the lesson that I'm bringing forward in my thinking? That's one method of classic Talmud study that doesn't seem to land in contradiction, but land in harmonization. Nonetheless, so you have the principle here. If we just would have kept that first one, and we would not have been overcome. I want to markedly point out that we weren't just shalta behen umah. It wasn't just that a nation came to rule us. It's that umah vilashon, the nation and their language, the cultural currency of that nation. The actual language that they're enforcing us to speak. Right? I mean, it says in the Midrash already that keeping our language was how we were able to really maintain a purposeful beingness as Jews within Egypt. That's what the Midrash offered. Among the things. Right? The language, the clothing,
names.
That's also language.
Are we writing? Do we know how to write when we're in Egypt?
I mean, if the first door was the door that ultimately gave us copies of the Torah and on the plaster of the stones wrote the law and of the, you know, there's a scribal group for sure. Moses is bringing us out and we have all those different kinds of writing going on.
Because it's interesting the emphasis the rabbi just gave to everything oral. Pretty oral concept. Right.
Yeah.
But the reification of the oral into the writing is what that allows you to really transmit it more so than just orally. Especially if you're under duress.
Right.
So
right.
That's why for you not to say writing seemed to me...
Well, here it's based on this kind of notion of the shilton, the umah, the power that's going to overcome you, being an umah. So within nationhood at that time, for sure codes matter, for sure laws matter, for sure written laws matter. What I'm interested in is also the notion here that you can be overcome without a language. Look what Yiddish was to so many Jews in Europe.
And the Catalan, wherever you go, it is this, what they did to Native American language, and they refused to let them speak. And this obliterating of culture through limiting or erasing language.
Right.
In fact, it's repeated over and over again. It's a very interesting insight.
Right. That's what I'm interested in here, in this duality of what it means to be overcome by this foreign power. And that I think that in today's great debate about the continuity of our peoplehood, it's fascinating to me that we're losing ground with Hebrew. So first of all, the Hisadrut Ivrit Shel America, the organization that was into promoting Hebrew language in America with monthly publication called L'Mishpacha, a Hebrew newspaper that was written in easier Hebrew that even had vowels, that went out of business about 13, 14 years ago. And then the Avichai Foundation, put a very, very significant amount of funding into a curriculum called Tal Am, which is a Hebrew language curriculum for schools across the Jewish board. There are two versions of their workbooks, one that has more frum-looking young people in the garb that they need, and one that has more modern, Jewishly acculturated garb. But both are foundationally about teaching our sacred texts and our language, Ivrit Modernit. And if I tell you that the Avichai Foundation has spent literally millions and millions of dollars on trying to put that into the circulation system of all of the school movements, they've really done a yeoman's job trying to promote Hebrew. Unfortunately, you know that the amount of liberal students in liberal Jewish day schools is declining. And Hebrew language instruction, even at those day schools, is falling by way of percentage of time spent on Hebrew language. Add that to the fact that Jaffe, who just has a new director of education, Jewish Agency for Israel, David Hoffman, very, very kind soul, sharp, sharp thinker, making plans with Nathan Sharansky now about what's going to be the trajectory of Jewish education in America vis-a-vis Israel. Well, Nefesh B'Nefesh is doing its aliyah job. There are still a couple shliachs doing the typical stuff shlichim did, except that now shlichim are not just looking to have people buy one-way tickets from America. That's a project, they say, not so worth it. But to have them here to do some Hebrew language instruction so that we can create a glue around the globe that will allow for Jewish continuity and Jewish interaction at the drop of a hat, so that we have a sense of language as bridge and language really as devek, as this glue of our peoplehood. They're now investing back in us. I'm sure we send this to them from the federations, but they're investing back in us the first $600,000 next year to start new programs in building Hebrew language capacity. It's an interesting phenomenon that they want to base some of the Jewish identity project in the buildup of language. When I was in Moscow recently, which you're where I went on the trip, maybe you were there for my discussion of such services. So one of the most fascinating pieces to me, one of the most unbelievable pieces, is that I could speak Hebrew to the 23, 24-year-old Moscovites who were the hippest, newest, brand-oriented, you know, Judaism is my brand kind of people, choosing this identity and writing dances to ancient Zionist songs to the house music beats that they'd mix in digitally. But we could speak Hebrew. They could tell me what this Russian food was that was from the kosher pizzeria, which is not pizza like with cheese, it's stringy turkey inside a pastry. But they could explain to me in Hebrew. One guy who was between Berlin and Moscow to have cooking classes where he introduced certain passages of the Gemara, Ardaf, about beets, fish, and garlic, could explain to me in Hebrew what he was doing. These weren't the people who spent all their lives in day school, and they weren't the people who spent all their lives in Jewish camps. They went to a couple of retreats. They decided to go to Israel for 3 and 4 months and take that first level ulpan, and any chance they got, they were speaking Hebrew. So I think that the notion here that colonialism, in a certain way, undermines the language of our peoplehood is fascinating. And secondly, whether or not it creates any kind of agenda within the rabbis' purview in the Gemara is a very interesting one, because of course they're bringing you at least to a currency of reading the written text. Shina Emar, Shina Emar. And mind you, there are texts in that time that did not get to so many times offering the proof texts in the actual text itself. It's just a word, or assumes you know it by mentioning one word. So there's this written language and this spoken language, and Aramaic as a currency in the time of the rabbis as a language of connection among Jews, of course, is a language that's used by more than just the Jews themselves, but Hebrew doesn't die. What's that?
I said ironic that Shinet Mar because it said not as it's written.
Right. It's true, but because we know that
it's a wonderful observation.
The orality is so essential. All right, let's push forward, though, because we're trying to not suffer. And if we had only had that first Shabbat, Uchativ Batre, and it says what? Vayavo Amalek. It's written that Amalek comes right afterwards. Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai Ilma Le Mishamrin Yisrael Shtei Shabbatot Kehilchatan. If the Jewish people would keep two Sabbaths according to their law, Miyad Nigalim, they would be redeemed immediately. Shene'emar, as it's written. Let me prove it to you. Ko Amar Hashem L'sarisim asher yishmeru et shabbatotai. So says Hashem regarding the eunuchs who observe my Sabbaths. Uchativ batrei v'haviotim el har kodshi. And it's written afterwards, I'll bring them to my holy mountain. In other words, being called names for not keeping the Sabbath until the time that we become Sabbath keepers. And we have these two Shabbatot. And how many times are people feeling like in their teens or their early 20s, and they're just getting to Israel, and they're becoming Jewish, and they're embracing their Judaism, and they're becoming a little bit interested in Shabbat, and they're growing in their Shabbos observance, and some teacher comes along and says, if only the Jews would keep two Shabboses according to their laws, the entire people would be redeemed. And it brings them this sense of participating in some holy drama, that the world could be redeemed if I do my part. And that's for real. For some people. And for others, it's, of course, you know, the exercise in what are we really trying to say, and what does that mean that Shabbat is connected to this taste of a redeemed world, a world to come, a taste of that vis-a-vis work and rest, a taste of that vis-a-vis a world somehow redeemed. Does it mean Mashiach? Does it mean simply a sense that people are, you know, get the rest they're due, and they shouldn't toil, and of course they shouldn't be enslaved or colonized? This is really a central limud when it comes to a central learning, a central teaching when it comes to Shabbat and what it could mean. And the fascinating part, of course, is A, Amalek is brought in between to say Amalek is obviously
a punishment,
or at least that it is the outcome of a world not redeemed, that Amalek comes and cuts you off at the weakest point and takes advantage of you. And two, now that you didn't do the first one, which is one, the limud is, now I have to have two. According to halakha, I have to state that not only am I doing it to make up for the one, but I'm committed. Is that a ding? So, wrong season. So I want to talk about this part of the Gemara for a minute. I'm going to send around a sheet, supplemental material, which you can take one and pass it down. Thank you. So there is an alternative to the if you keep two as the follow-up to we lost the world redeemed because of the first one we broke, then Amalek comes. What's the alternative? The Jerusalem Talmud says something a little different. Amar Rabbi Levi, Ilu Ayu Yisrael Mishamrim Shabbat Echad Ketikna Miyad Haya Ben David Ba. Rabbi Levi said, if Israel kept one Shabbat correctly, the son of David would immediately come. So, but the Bavli, as you see in the paper here, says, like what we just read, if it's two, so what's the difference? What do you think the two Gemaras are saying? Why do you think there might be two different traditions out there?
Well, can I just throw out another question? I mean, the other differences are we to understand that Miyad Hayab and David, but that the son of David would come, is the same as Nigalim, or does Nigalim being redeemed imply something greater than just Ben David Ba, that would require two Shabbatot instead of one?
Good. So, good question. You're a plant.
Sure. Not look at the
son. Also, Ben David is the son of
Right.
Son of David is at this point. That's a good question, though, for this point. Let's ask as if we were sitting there at that time. We might understand it as the Messiah because of what we know about the history of Messianic thinking in Israel. But at the time, the idea that Ben David is the Messiah is an idea about Messiah that's circulating around the Jewish community.
But it could also be a secular king who's going to reunite us both with secular power as well as religious power in our own land.
That's right. So it doesn't have to be only Messianic.
Well, that ties in with Bavli when it says that Israel had it served just one Shabbat, then a foreign power, and
right.
Exactly. So this might even not be the typical messianic look at Ben David that we would assume, because we think of Ben David in our understanding, Yamim Ha'elu, these days, as messianic. And the notion that messianic thinking, or that an age of redemption has to be Messiah, is not necessarily tied to Ben David as Mashiach Hashem was sent from some supernal place. But that is a power that rises up again. So, I brought Heinrich Gretz's work on messianism within our culture, which was translated by Ismar Shorish of the seminary. One of his great accomplishments, Professor Shorish, is was to translate Gretz's work. Just as an introduction again to Heinrich Gretz, it's worth reading that he was the most energetic, versatile, and durable practitioner. I like the way that Chancellor Shorish worded things all the time. He spoke like this as well. Of Wissenschaft des Judentums in the 19th century. His comprehensive 11-volume History of the Jews, published from 1853 to 1876 at the torrid pace of approximately a book every 2 years, along with numerous other monographs and several revised editions of earlier volumes, still remains a century later the best single introduction to the totality of Jewish history. Good sales job. This collection of essays includes his famous The Stages of in the Evolution of the Messianic Belief. And within that, he says, that there's lots of speculation about when the Messianic Age will come. The prophets themselves talk about Judah and Israel being united in the land of Judah. It's all about political sovereignty within our land. There's not actually an individual pointed out. It goes through in a couple of pages in the essay to show that, in fact, that governing ourselves and being rulers in our own land and having our Kohenic group run the temple is a fine vision of the age of redemption for a lot of the prophets. Of course, that there has to be pure prayer involved or pureness of heart, treating the widow kindly, the orphan. Then it says, the Babylonian Amoraic sage Shmuel, Samuel, 200 to 258, openly stated that in the Messianic era there would be neither miracles nor supernatural events, but only the redemption of Israel from its state of political servitude among the nations. In contrast, his contemporary, Yehoshua ben Levi, portrayed the Messiah as existing since creation. So, afflicted with leprosy and residing among the lepers in Rome, this is Perek HaChelek in Sanhedrin, 11th chapter, he waited for the call any minute to fulfill his mission. Others refused to accept this mystical pre-existence of the Messiah and contended that God would only create him when the need arose. To be sure, this excessive glorification of the Messiah rested on faulty biblical exegesis. While one preacher made him equal to Moses, another placed him not only above Abraham and Moses, but also above the angels. But the more the Messiah was glorified and exalted, the less did other biblical descriptions fit him. For example, he would head an army, be defeated, and be pierced by a sword. But the fantasy-rich mythic mentality was not fazed by this at all. It gave birth to a second Messiah, a Messiah from the tribe of Joseph or Ephraim, Mashiach ben Yosef, who would first clear the path for redemption and for the real Messiah to come. And then, the Messiah from the house of David, after he was stabbed, would appear in the clouds in exalted majesty. He would complete the work of peace and even resurrect the slain Messiah from the dead.
Difference is in the word immediately, because maybe there is all of this kind of mythology about the stages of the Son of David and what will happen with the one, but with the two, you don't have to wait for all those intermediary stages.
The first one, they say miyad hayah ben David bai, who says it immediately on the first and the second.
Yeah. Yeah, they're both there.
The end of that theory.
Yeah. But you could. But you know what? But Bobby, that's the way. Form criticism and manuscript work sometimes works from a question like that. Can I find it? Is there a manuscript that does not have miyad in one but has it in the other? Anyway, that's the glory of having Shama Friedman win the Israel Prize this year, and his great library of manuscripts that is now digitized. You could search that question instantaneously, and he's a professor, of course, at the Schechter Institute in Jerusalem, who won the Israel Prize this year for his great work in Talmudic research.
No, but wait, the Son of David would immediately come, but the redemption would not be. The second one, the redemption is immediate. The other is the immediacy of his coming.
Good question.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Maybe they're not equivalent. Maybe there is different stages about.
Right. Right, that's the thought of the other Rav. So, turn over the page. I apologize, I don't have translations, but it's sometimes good to work our way into some Hebrew text. And if you'd like to follow along in the Hebrew, you know, I always say, worth a try, see what you recognize, see what you don't. If you don't want to, you can, of course, sit and listen, and I'll translate as we go. But I thought it was interesting to show you. This is a production of Masada Rav Kook. It's from the Rav Kook Yeshiva. It's a compilation of Hasidic sources, commentary on the Gemara, the use of Talmudic sources within Talmudic, the use of Talmudic sources within Hasidic literature interests me as a concept, as a who's relating to Gemara and who's not in the library of Hasidic culture. It interests me to see where they take things either towards the mystical understanding or a little bit more towards midrashic understanding. They reach back in time to texts to interpret it by way of the rabbinic texts, or do they go more towards Kabbalistic texts, and are they, in that sense, popularizing mystical ideas, which the Hasidic movement was really all about? And they were a little bit more complicated than the Martin Buber take on Hasidic sources, that they were kind of democratizing Judaism for all, and that they were making learning less important, but feeling more, the cultural currency. So there's learning going on. So just to give you a sense of what the text is saying, that a lot of times the Zohar is brought up as work that impacts their understandings of Talmudic texts, and that's very poetic commentary on the Torah itself and on the Talmud itself. Midrashic in form, using Aramaic in a Middle Ages Aramaic way to try to sound like Aramaic of the early centuries because of the Zoharic connection to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. that he's the author. Anyway, it says, Ita Bazohar, I'm on the first source, which is basically the third paragraph in small Hebrew letters after our sentence is bolded, where it says Sham. Ita Bazohar, V'dibrot Rishonot Ne'amar Zachor Yom HaShabbat. With the Ten Commandments, the first one, it says Zachor at Yom HaShabbat, when it talks about what you're going to do with Sabbath. Remember the Sabbath day. Zachor at Yom HaShabbat. V'dibrot Ha'achronot, but in the later mention of the Ten Commandments, Ne'amar Shamor. It said Shamor. So what is this? In other words, the question is, Mishamrin Yisrael Shtei Shabbatot. The Gemara here says it wants us to guard or keep the two Sabbaths. It didn't say Zochrin, to remember. It didn't use the first verse, like within the first set of the Ten Commandments. It used the verb that's used in the second set of the Ten Commandments. So he's going to do something with that. Zachor l'dechura, shamor l'nukva. Zachor is the masculine emanation of divinity. And shamor, and keep and guard, is the feminine emanation of divinity within Shabbat.
Are you skipping purposely the line above about the difference between the neshama and the guf?
No, that's the continuation of the...
Yeah.
It's on the same line.
Yeah, that's right after where I'm reading.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right. Zachor hi aneshama. When it says remember, that's over and against the soul. In other words, when it says zachor, there's a soul connection. There's a connection to an neshama. The nukva hu haguf, and the feminine aspect that I'm referring to is the physical body. They don't care about whether or not the word neshama is feminine in grammar. They don't care whether it's masculine. They're going to tell you which side. So right now we're in a mapping of mystical engagement with Shabbat. There's a feminine aspect and a male aspect, meaning there are aspects of it that I bring together to make a unity within my experience so that I bring to life both the soul world and the physical world. Personal soul world, personal body, world of souls. World of physical manifestation. Hamekabel Shefa, the body that receives a divine effluence. V'na'aseh kli l'haneshama shebetocho. And that is a vessel, the body, for the soul that it keeps. Uvehitchaber shnehem. And when the two of them come together, az zachor v'shamor b'dibor echad. Then we get to what L'chad Odi, the song says on Kabbalat Shabbat, that Zachor and Shamor, remember and guard, come together at once, as one. So what's the traditional way of understanding the Ten Commandments that says remember, and the Ten Commandments that say Shamor over there in Deuteronomy, this one in Exodus, this one in Deuteronomy? Really, God spoke both of those at once on Sinai, and the Midrash says that was in one time, B'dibor Echad, that was in one statement, Shamor and Zachor. The Hasidic master is saying, when it says Shamor and Zachor, it means that the soul and the body will come together. The soul and the body of a human in experiencing the Sabbath, and the soulness and the corporealness of our world on Shabbat will come together. The divinity that's kind of ethereal, and the reality in which we have Shabbat. Shamadrega hatachtona niksheret el hamadrega ha'elyona. The lower worldliness connects with the upper worldliness. Zehu, and that is to say, ilmale shamru Yisrael Shabbat rishona. If Israel would have really kept the first Shabbat, ritzono lamar lekasher Shabbat tata'a hanikra shamur el Shabbat debechina rishona shehu lamala mehateva. Lo shalta behem uma v'lashon. That if the Sabbath would have been kept with a connection between the supernal world and the very corporeal world, Israel, the Jewish people, would never have been overcome by the outside forces, colonized, ruled. The Ma'amar Hasheni Mashlim et HaRishon, and this statement, the second, fills in our understanding of the first, Ilmale Mishamrim Yisrael Shtei Shabbatot. So the second statement of the Talmud that said, if you keep two Sabbaths, then there would be redemption. It fills out our understanding of the first mention of when we neglected to keep the first Shabbat and ruling powers overcame us. Hainu, that is to say, Shehayu mechalalin shtei Shabbatot hanizkar l'mala, that we did not understand the full nature of Shabbat, that it was connected to both the world of neshama, the soul, and the world below, the body, the corporeal. That we could have taken the notion of shamor that had a aspect to it, which is nukva, which is the feminine, and the zachor, which is the male, and that there were these two kinds of aspects of keeping Shabbat that we had to be engaged with, both the soul level and the bodily level, and therefore, if we do that now, it's made more benigle, it's more revealed to us in the second statement of the Gemara. If we'll just keep two Shabbatot, meaning the two aspects of Shabbat, we'll have redemption. What is it arguing for? It's arguing for an inner life. The Hasidic master knows it's not enough to put beats on the table and make it a bodily time where you're just not doing the rest of what you're not doing. There are other sources where bringing together the neshama and the guf of Shabbat is making Shabbat not only this kind of day set aside and going through the motions of making the meal, but it's the level of soul investment, let's say, to go back to the word investment. It's the level of making the Shabbat experience. And you can feel the difference when someone's making Shabbat versus when someone comes for Shabbat. If I want to make Shabbat, I'm, I think, closer to what this source is trying to reveal. And I'm putting together this kind of supernal and soul life with the reality that my body's walking to do such a thing or sitting down to eat such a meal.
I think there's something else going on here, and that is a movement away from individual responsibility to collective responsibility.
How so? How do you see that?
Because here the punishment is meted out because a few Jews didn't follow the process. But we have a very long tradition of individual responsibility, not necessarily collective responsibility as well. Going back to Abraham arguing for Sodom and Gomorrah, when there's a revolt by only the people who revolted were put to death, and the people rebelled, they died out in the desert. But it was the people who rebelled that died, not their wives, not their children. So this notion of the impact going beyond the individual to the community, I think is in tension with a lot of what I interpret as a countervailing in Jewish thought and philosophy.
What's counter? You mean because of the kind of Abrahamic notion?
Well, I'm just saying that this notion that because a few Jews picked up, went out, that this then creates the collective punishment and Kopelet and Amalek. That sort of, to me is very different than Jews being individually responsible for their actions and suffering the consequences, good and bad, for their own individual actions, as opposed to being responsible or suffering for what others do, other Jews happen to do that may not be in keeping with religion.
Right, and what's leading you to believe that only individual responsibility and not collective responsibility for Am Yisrael on behalf of a few?
Because I think we have a long series of examples where those who actually do the violation and only them are held accountable and suffer the punishment.
It's interesting because I think that there's a turn in the Torah in that regard, vis-a-vis Abraham, then towards the brothers and Joseph. I think by the time you're done with Genesis, you realize that the entire people will be affected and impacted by the decisions of one or another, for better or for worse, in certain ways. You know, that I didn't take responsibility for my brother being thrown into the pit and redeem him, or B, that you don't really get all the voices of the brothers, but all of them are, in essence, guilty, outside of Benjamin.
But they all had a chance to do the right thing, and they chose not to. So that is individual responsibility.
Okay.
Oh, it's interesting, though, that in this, but in this, the punishment seems appropriate to what happened, which is that had they all done this together, they would have been a united people. Had they all followed the Shabbat, then it would have proved their coherence and their strength in the face of an attack, an outside attack. And they weren't strong enough by staying together as a people to withstand the attack. So you do have to be people who can follow directions, people who can listen to a leader, people who can work together in order to withstand the kind of, and what they're talking about in terms of the punishment is a punishment that comes when people are not cohesive.
Right.
Can you describe to me our life nowadays, if at that time the Jewish people would keep the Shabbat?
No.
So that's the point.
I mean, there are many, many thoughts. I mean, if you want to talk about where this article goes and the different concepts of what people would buy into if they...
I wonder if our life nowadays would be different.
If you wanted to put your trust into Severus or Abu Isa in 8th century Syria, you might be hoping for a time when the law goes back to a very simple statement of the Torah, and because they're the precursors to the Karaites, and it might look like we were following the Torah and even more quote-unquote what seems to us today's world severe interpretation of the Torah and its laws, and instead there was a rewriting of Talmudic legislation. And people felt like it wasn't redemptive. So I think over time, your question does touch upon the notion that people did have a vision of what redeemed life would be, and it looked so different from the prophets when the rabbis interpreted it, and it looked so different from the rabbis when you had messianic movements throughout the ages, and that is part of what we can observe historically, that we don't have a real answer, and B, we have several answers by way of what people did hope over time, and that's the beauty of this historical investigation that Gretz did.
You know, it's a fork in the road of the Jewish people that we don't know which the other road takes us.
Yeah.
So it's not fair.
Right.
So it's not fair. I mean, the argument is not... It's not even...
It's not meant to be fair. It's just... It's a religious hope that sometimes in our purview.
Like. I mean, we have a model.
But the notion that redemption is Eden is, for many, not the model.
I can understand people could say that. All I'm saying is, in the Torah, we have an example of an existence before we do something wrong. So it doesn't seem illogical that if we do enough right things, we get back to where we started from before we did something wrong.
When we think of their ideal situation would have been the Solomonic kingdom, where you do have the concentration or the coincidence of both secular and sacred power under your own control, and you are fulfilling the word of God. I mean, that would seem to me...
That is the prophetic vision.
That would seem to me what they would be seeking.
If we were going with the prophets and we thought there was internal midrash and understanding of what we're trying to achieve, it's oftentimes this notion of political and religious sovereignty and not the notion of returning to what is considered God, except that there are those who, like Barry, you're saying, look at some of the language within the prophets and hear hints of the first story of creation.
Well, you have a
and that notion that there is embedded within there that kind of...
The bountifulness of the land. I mean, you can see the parallels.
Yeah, knowledge of God.
Knowledge.
Da'at. It's a da'at. This brought down.
From the get-go, from Adam and Eve, human beings are disobedient. And
thus we're banished.
And so, in a way it feels like, it's only, but there's no record of that as a real possibility.
So it's not always we were disobedient.
Yeah.
So what do we say, Rob?
Na'aseh v'nishma.
You have to stop focusing so much on punishment and disobedience.
We will do, and then we will hear, then we will consider.
Some of these things, this is how it has to unravel and how it has to go forward. So the discussion here isn't supposed to be you're being punished and this is what's happening. It's trying to stress the importance of Shabbat and talk about what happens and how you go forward and rebuild. But the notion you were talking about punishment in the third and fourth generation, that's not the concept that's going on.
But if they said that we are going to believe all this.
Okay, but rewarded means something good is going to happen.
Oh, we're going to be redeemed.
It's not the opposite of being punished.
We're going to be redeemed.
It's not rewarded.
So I think that it's worth going on to just a little bit of Gemara before we leave for the night. It's rich conversation. Let's just go here. I'm on 118b2. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Yehe chelki me'ochlei shalosh sudot b'shabbat. May my portion be among those who eat three meals on the Sabbath. Back to some halacha l'maaseh. There are three meals to eat, and he wants my portion to be among them. Amar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi says, Yehe chelki me'gomrei halel b'chol yom. May my portion be among those who complete the halel every day. What? The halel? Ain't he? Right? That's the kind of word that you love in the Gemara. Hey, really? You have that tradition? But I have a teaching from the Master. One who recites the Hallel every day is thereby belittling and blaspheming God. So, what is Hallel in this case? Hallel, perhaps from this understanding, so far in the Sugi, is the Hallel that we sing at holiday time, the special collection of psalms that are stated, but the Gemara answers, ki ka'amarinan, in regard to what we say, that one should complete the Hallel every day, p'suke de zimra, it's really that we're talking about p'suke de zimra. We're just calling that Hallel in this case. We're not talking about the Hallel, don't worry so much that it's the Hallel that you're thinking of that is ordained for certain times. It's p'suke de zimra, meaning the collection of psalms that we say before, Shema uvirchotea, Shema and its blessings in the morning service. Amar Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Yossi says, Yehe chelki mimit palim im dimdume hama. May my portion be among those who pray during the redness of the sun. Meaning, you get up early and you come at Netzah Shachar, you come when just the sun is out, and also at nighttime though, when I pray Bein HaArbayim, when I pray in that twilight zone of the redness of the sky. They thought that praying in these times were very, very profound. And when you say Ma'ariv Aravin, who rolls out the evening, you can physically see the rolling out the evening. And when you say the morning prayer, the Shacharit, Natan L'Sech Vivina, gave the rooster wisdom and the crow of the rooster, you're up and you're there and you're saying your prayers. Amar Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Mitzvah lehitpalel im dimdumei chama. It's a mitzvah to pray during the redness of the sun. Amar Rabbi Zeira, and Rabbi Zeira says, Maikara, what's the source in scripture? Yiraucha im shamesh v'lifnei yareach dor dorin. May they revere you with the shining of the sun and before the moon shines through all the generations. And you know that there are times that are posted that are the right times to daven according to one community versus another, in the time of Shema, in the time of this. But Netzach Hama, the time of the kind of up, the sun, when the sun comes up in the morning, is always posted among those tables. And of course you have Plaga Mincha, which is the halfway mark between in the middle of Mincha Ketana, the second half of a rabbinic day that's made for the small time of saying Mincha. But you also sometimes have Bein Harbayim noted, that it's the kind of the ideal time between the twilight, right? And that you should strive to pray there. Amar Rabbi Yossi, Yehei Chalki Mimei Tei V'Chole Me'ayim. And here we have some medical kind of reference. May my portion be among those who die of intestinal disease. What's the one? Damar Mar, Master says, Ruban Shel Tzadikim Meitim V'Chole Me'ayim. The majority of tzaddikim die because of intestinal disease. Now, what does that really mean? We're not exactly sure. But we do know that people who ate and were, enjoyed their lives, and that the one commentary here in the ancient world said that they felt like people who lived a good life and who had a little meat on the bone were considered to die from this, even when they didn't know the causes. So that's one take on what he's saying. You know, a little bit more than that I can't give you right now, except that 31, the note says this is a very painful form of death. However, those who suffer through it are cleansed of their sins. So meaning they chose this kind of notion of saying, like, if I really suffer in this world, right, I won't suffer in that world. And that's kind of the notion of...
They would cut open the animals and use that to be prophecy. So I
think you're seeing a heritage of that. I think it's about the pain, frankly. Amar Rabbi Yossi, let's push on to one last piece. Rabbi Yossi said, Yehei chalki mimeitei b'derech mitzvah. May my portion be among those who die on the way to perform a mitzvah. And that makes sense. But Amar Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Yossi says, Yehei chalki memachnisei Shabbat b'Tiberia u'mimotzei Shabbat b'Tzipori. May my portion be among those who begin the Sabbath in Tiberia and who end the Sabbath in Tzipori. And Rashi there says that they put bosen, they put beautiful perfumes on their clothing, and they have a beautiful reach, a smell of Shabbat. And I'll leave it at this, that the physical manifestation of Sabbath in the world, if we get back to the soul and body connection, if we get back to the Kavanah intentionality and not just going through the motions kind of pieces, that Rabbi Yossi is noticing that could be really what happens in these places. And he's going to tell you that rabbinic culture also matters. Rabbi Yossi says, Yehei chalki mimoshevei beit ha-midrash v'chol ma'amidei beit ha-midrash. May my portion be among those appointed to seat the students in the house of study and not among those appointed to stand them on their feet in the house of study, meaning I get to schmooze with the people in the good seats. V'amar Rabbi Yossi, and he says, Yehei chalki begaba'ei tzedakah v'lo mimchalkei tzedakah. And may my portion be among the charity collectors and not among the distributors. It's so difficult to do such work. And Amar Rabbi Yossi, last piece here for the night, Yehei chalki mimi shechoshdin oto ve'ein bo. And may my portion be among those who are suspected but are really free of guilt. To the nature of humanity in the end, and figuring out whether or not we will truly suspect people of having ulterior motives or not. And there's someone who takes this limud, this lesson, one of the Musar rabbis of Simcha Zissel, who said, one of the most difficult things is to not either second-guess someone or suspect someone of sometimes doing things not exactly with pure motives. But it's not our job to judge. It's only God's.
Thank you.
Thank you. No, I wanted. Do we have a little Geniza here? We have a Geniza for books that need to be buried. Our position on papers going to Rabbi Westwood.
Yes, I know. I remember.